Edwina Farley with you. Now, are you one of those people who thinks drought-stricken farmers have made their beds and now they should lie in them?
I get quite tired of people say you choose to live there. It's great that people do choose to live here because someone's got to live here. And the people that live here enjoy living here. They do it because they like it. But if they didn't like it, there'd be a huge vacuum in regional Australia, and there'd be no one there to maintain the roads, there'd be no one there to bring beef into the abattoirs and onto ships.
Today, A Country Breakfast meets the towns who are doing something to help themselves. First, though, we'll find out all the big stories of the week from Rural News with Tony Allen. And Tony, some sort of late week news about a very significant deal that's finally been ratified with China.
Well, Australia believes that the market in China for live cattle, both for slaughter at abattoirs and for breeding dairy herds, is going to be as big, if not bigger, than the live cattle export industry to Indonesia. But there's been quite a lot of sorting out that had to be done, including health protocols and welfare protocols. Well, this week, China ratified the export agreement that's going to give unprecedented market access to Australian cattle. The Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says China has signed the Cattle Health Protocol Agreement, and that makes us a step closer to sending cattle to China. He says it's now up to the exporters to ensure that all the animal welfare standards under the SCAS system are in order, and the first trial shipment of cattle from Australia, live cattle, will go to China by air.
This is a process that allows basically you to test the supply chain, and this allows immediate transport, you know, within one day. I think we'll see more of this in the future. It won't be the norm. It'll be a very, very small part of the market, but it is, it's a vital part of the market.
Still in Asia, and we heard some good news this week of some extra permits for live cattle to Indonesia, but then a bit of a cabinet reshuffle there.
Yes, well, the change of mind on Indonesia over how many cattle it would take from Australia is indicative of a bit of turmoil happening in the Indonesian cabinet. And the Indonesian president has reshuffled his cabinet. He's dumped his trade minister, Rahmat Gobel, and appointed Mr. Thomas Lembong as the new trade minister. What it means really is that the President Joko Widodo thought the cabinet was underperforming and was unstable. And we've got some agreement there from Professor Greg Feely from the Australian National University, who's an expert on Indonesian politics. He says an example of this was the Indonesia's dramatic reduction of permits for live cattle from Australia and then suddenly issuing another 50,000 to help reduce the price of beef.
That was one of the conclusions that people have drawn, that there's been disarray in the trade portfolio. My only question would be, how much of this do we sheet back to the outgoing trade minister, Rahmat Gobel, and how much do we put, in fact, more broadly on the cabinet? Because there is a general mood, beginning with the president himself, that Indonesia has to be more self-sufficient in food.
Now, wheat is our biggest grain export, and there's been a bit of a bounce in all those cropping farm steps this week because there's been good rain.
Yes, interestingly, this week the wheat price has fallen, and some other prices like that of sorghum have also fallen because China has devalued the yuan. But if you are a wheat grower, there is good news in some areas like southern New South Wales and the wheat belt of Western Australia, because there's been good rain in recent weeks, the soil is more moist, and the commodity forecasters have upgraded their outlook for the national wheat crop. National Australia Bank economist Finn Zabel now expects more than the 20 million tonne national wheat crop the bank had initially forecast for the season. But as always, it's almost like a broken record this, they still need follow-up rains in spring.
As always, everybody's just looking for rain, I think. Some areas more than others. Some areas are doing all right, and others, the yields will hinge on that spring rain. But if they get it in a lot of those places, things shouldn't be too bad.
Farmers were pretty disappointed this week with the federal government's ambitions on carbon emissions.
Well, actually, the response did vary a little bit. For industries like dairy, some of the farmers are worried that toughening the carbon emissions targets will make it harder for industries like dairies and piggeries, so on, which do produce quite a lot of methane emissions. But there is one group of farmers who wrote to the Liberal Party annual conference earlier this year wanting very strong emissions cuts, and they're not happy. The government is expected to back an emissions reduction target of 26 to 28% by 2030, and that's well short of the 40% cut by 2025 that group of farmers nominated to the Liberal Party. One of them is farmer Sid Plant from the Darling Downs of Queensland. He signed that letter and says this is just not good enough.
Their targets, I think, are just nowhere near the mark. And as a farmer, we're feeling the effects of climate change as hard and as early as anybody in the world. We're already dealing with the world's highest rainfall variability, so it's getting difficult enough now without locking in 3 or 4%.
A bit of a blow for seafood labelling laws.
Well, in the Northern Territory, for some time you've been able to go to a restaurant or to a fish and chip shop and see your food labelled on the menu as where it comes from, whether it's local or whether it's imported. A group of crossbench senators, including the Greens, wanted to make that national. And Nick Xenophon, the independent senator, was also involved. They proposed tightening the national seafood labelling laws for restaurants, fish and chip shops, hotels and so on, requiring menus to label seafood as local or imported. Now, both the Labor Party and the Coalition voted against this, and the bill got rolled this week in the Senate. So the crossbench senators might now put pressure on state governments to follow the Northern Territory's lead. But Tasmanian Senator Peter Wish-Wilson says the chain of information from fishermen does break down once the seafood gets to restaurants, shops or hotels.
When that fish goes to the wholesale markets, for example, the Sydney fish markets, they also have very extensive labelling requirements. And then when it gets to the back of the seafood restaurant, it doesn't go the extra 20 feet to the table. All that information gets lost.
Now, I still remember the photos and TV news stories of all those tractors rolling into Parliament House, and I can't believe it was 10 years ago.
Yes, 10 years ago this week, 8 tractors left Devonport in Tasmania bound for Canberra. The farmers who drove them were very upset that a contract for frozen chips had been cancelled and had gone to New Zealand, which was offering cheaper prices. That started it. The farmers wanted better food of country of origin labelling, better transparency in marketing, and they started up what they called the Fair Dinkum Food Campaign. Those tractors went across Bass Strait. They went through regional Victoria and New South Wales, gathering a lot more tractors on the way, and then they ended up with a big rally, which got a lot of publicity in Canberra. Now, this week, 10 years later, some of the veterans lined up at an onion shed near Devonport, bearing the original placards used on the convoy, and some of the original speakers at the rally spoke again, including vegetable grower Nathan Richardson. He reflected on what had been achieved and what still needed to be done to make sure Australia did have a secure vegetable processing industry.
Well, my wish for Australian industry and agriculture is that we all support each other. We're not fragmented. We need to give clear direction to the policymakers in those industry groups that, hey, we're a country, what's our goal, what do we really want to be in 10 years or 5 years or 20 years, and how are we going to do it?
Now, goats could be a source of income for Indigenous people in New South Wales.
Yes, you wouldn't think a feral goat was worth much, but they actually get $4.70 a kilo or thereabouts on the market if you can catch them. And there's plenty of them about. The New South Wales government is offering the Aboriginal people in Western New South Wales contracts to make good money from harvesting goats in several national parks and nature reserves. Andrew Ball from the National Park Service says the traditional owners will be able to get contracts to muster the goats, kill them and sell them.
Last year alone we removed around 9,000 goats from the parks in the Bourke area. When the landscape is in drought, as we've seen recently, vegetation is having a hard time already. But when goats are out there and there's not much else surviving, goats will really hammer vegetation, and that affects the entire ecosystem.
We've heard about farm machinery and property being the target of thieves, but beehives are the latest area of concern.
This is very serious. It's almond pollination season in the almond orchards of northwest Victoria, and a large number of beehives are brought in by contractors to help pollinate the almonds. Now, this happens every year. This year, about 110 hives have been reported stolen around Swan Hill and Robinvale. They're worth an estimated $40,000. And police are urging the farmers and the beekeepers to be very vigilant But they do have their suspects. They do think it's somebody involved in orchards, in pollination. Why would they want so many beehives? Detective Senior Constable Mal Simpson from the Swan Hill Crime Investigation Unit says he's aware that more hives are still needed in the local orchards, so more properties could be targeted by the thieves.
Yeah, it's a concern because we've been made aware there are a shortage of hives. So if there's a shortage and they're not in a specific area, it may someone may take advantage of that by stealing hives and transporting to that area where these people think they need them.
So if you see a beehive being mysteriously transported, give police a buzz.
That touche. Thank you, Tony. You can find details of all those stories on our website and see some photos of hives in the orchard. They're very pretty. abc.net.au/rural.
Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens, taking on all the big issues and not really helping at all.
Waleed, you've been arguing that what Australian politicians need to learn is from the fast food industry.
All I can think of is burgers now, Scott. The philosophy of burgers. Join us on The Minefield.
The Minefield. Today, 1:30, here on RN.
On RN, this is A Country Breakfast and I'm Edwina Farley. Time to hit the road with our rural reporters. This week it's all about food. We're eating weeds in Geary, learning about growing bush raisins, and visit Australia's southernmost tropical nut farm. Would you believe it's not far from Melbourne? We also try our hand at cooking jams and preserves to enter in the Royal Queensland Show.
Show cooking is different from home cooking, and with show cooking you must abide by all of the rules and the regulations. If at first you don't succeed, then you need to rethink it all, measure your ingredients, do a trial batch. If it doesn't work, try again.
Oh, the devil is in the detail when it comes to show cooking. We're off to the Ekka a bit later. But our culinary tour starts today in Geary, where weeds are on the menu.
We'll be having some stinging nettle gnocchi, some weedy pesto.
That sounds appetising.
Yeah. You'll love it, Dougal, I promise.
Long communal tables are set up along the footpath on the edge of the Mitchell Highway, colourful tablecloths and candles laid out. The main road through Geary, a tiny country town in the central west of New South Wales, has never seen anything like it. Hi, I'm Dougal Saunders. Tonight, Geary is hosting a dinner that features edible weeds.
We'll be having a Moroccan mallow and lamb stew that we're using some local Geary mints, which is very exciting. And for dessert, Matilda's made some lovely little things with edible flowers. So, yeah, we're following the theme all through.
The community event is the brainchild of Violet Siebert, a reasonably recent arrival from Melbourne. She wants people to see weeds in a new light, as delicious and tasty, not just something that needs to be pulled out and sprayed.
I got given an edible weeds handbook a few years ago by my little brother, and that just got me passionate about weeds, and I started the craze in Melbourne. And when I moved to Geary, I just realised that there were even more here because there's just so much more land.
So the idea of eating weeds is just to, from your point of view, it's just to make use of something that we wouldn't normally use. Is that the theory?
That is part of it. I really like, I feel like it's sustainable eating, which is exciting. And just the feeling of going out into the open and foraging and picking something that you're going to eat, it's a very satisfying and sort of grounding feeling. And they're very, very good for you as well, which is a bonus. But the best thing, they're free.
They're free. It's all based on having something weedy in each course, basically.
Every course has something weedy. Every course. Even the salad is completely made up of weeds.
You're saying that with joy in your eyes.
I know. I am, because one, I'm proud, but also I'm just excited to see people's reactions to actually eating the weeds.
Tell you what, I'm going to be pretty excited to see what people are.
Just watching. Yeah.
So, what do tonight's diners think of their weedy dinner? Well, if the empty plates are anything to go by, the meal has been a great success.
Hi, I'm Karen.
Yes, the green round things were lovely. The gnocchi, of course.
That was the stinging nettle gnocchi.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was your favourite?
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you expecting the range of dishes we had?
Not at all. No, look, I'm a big fan of green. I like green on my plate, lots of green, and the variety of green was just abundance tonight, wasn't it?
Really was, but normally it might be beans or peas or broccoli. Tonight it was stinging nettles, dandelions, sour leaves, all this sort of weird and wonderful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, and that was just wonderful. It's not stuff we have at home, is it?
Well, I was thinking maybe I'd be a bit hungry, but I ate like a bit of an oinker tonight, to be honest.
Absolutely, yes, I'm full to the boot.
Hi, I'm Liza. I enjoyed lots of things. I enjoyed the food and lots of good people.
What was your favourite dish, do you think?
I like the entree, which was a weed...
Weed pie?
Weed pie, yeah.
Hey, Kathy, what did you enjoy most so far?
Well, apart from the wonderful company, all of the dishes are just really delicious, but I particularly liked the meatballs.
Oh, they were delicious, weren't they?
I have no idea what was in them, apart from weeds.
There was a weed. There was nice meat, but there were weeds in there as well, but they were pretty well disguised.
Just beautiful, that was, yes.
Yeah.
Kate Blackley. Well, apart from meeting people from the village that I hadn't had the opportunity to meet before, and that's been fantastic, trying something that I've never tried before, it was all really delicious, and I am dying to get the recipes.
Were you slightly sceptical before coming here? Were you thinking, what am I actually going to get served?
Well, I was aware that there was going to be nettle gnocchi, and as I looked at all the nettles growing underneath our trees at the farm, I was thinking... I hope it's a great recipe because I've got a lot to work with here. I can harvest my own.
They were one of the standouts. Everyone mentioned the nettle gnocchi. There was great fettuccine. The lamb was delicious.
Delicious, yeah. And now we've just had the most delicious petit fours that they've made using lavender and violets and rose water and the Rocky Road. Phenomenal. Slice and the lime slice.
I was wondering about the marshmallow in the Rocky Road, whether it was from marshmallow weeds, because I couldn't think of anything too weedy in the Rocky Road, to be honest. It was very nice.
I'm sure that the roses that were growing where the rose water came from perhaps had weeds underneath.
See, you're a thinker. You're a thinker.
Craig Whiteley.
Craig, you would normally be out spraying much of this sort of stuff out of crops. How have you felt munching on it tonight?
Well, I was a little concerned. I was worried about a little alkaloid poisoning in some of the variegated thistle dishes, but so far so good. I was hoping to get a little bit of tiger pear tapas, but I didn't.
How long have you been thinking of that line?
As long as I've been cutting tiger pear.
Overall, this has been a different experience, I think, for most people. Do you reckon you'll be searching some of your paddocks now? I mean, you've got nettles, we know that. Anything else you might be scouting around for now, do you think?
It'll put a whole new perspective on what's growing on the farm. I think, we've got untapped potential here.
We do. Who needs a corn crop or a loosen crop?
Go for the weeds.
We'll be spraying out those weeds and wheat crops now.
And as a truck goes past, it's just a reminder, we are in the main drag here, which has been... I mean, it's been a completely different experience as well. Have you enjoyed that?
Fantastic. Fantastic. A very underutilised.
I said to someone tonight, this is the first time that I've eaten in the main street of Geary in all my life. So perhaps a new experience.
So, Violet, basically the end of the night now. Everyone's still smiling. Everyone seems to have really enjoyed themselves. What about you? Have you enjoyed yourself?
I have had an absolute blast. And just looking around, I can see everyone smiling even more than when they arrived.
Well, I mean, to be honest, the dinner has surprised everyone.
It has,
I think. It was delicious, filling, and sort of unexpected. So well done.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it was unexpected. A couple of the men, actually, were saying that they were a little bit reluctant to come this evening, but they kept an open mind, and when they got here, they just were very, very happy and very excited and sort of couldn't believe what they were eating.
Can we expect then, I mean, this dinner's been an obvious success, it's been a smash hit. More weed dinners on the way, do you reckon?
Yes, well, we'll be doing a dinner every season, so for a year. So the next one is spring, and we'll be doing a spring lamb, but... the one after that will be the summer one, and I'd like to do a summer weeds dinner because we've seen the winter weeds and, you know, it's a chance to see the summer ones.
Have you ever tried to weed a cat head? I mean, that could be tough.
It's funny, before I moved to Geary, burrs were not anything that I'd ever considered, and now they're a really big part of my life. It's quite strange.
When you think of a specialist niche crop, then bush raisins would have to be pretty high on the list. The harvest is measured in kilos, not tonnes, and you don't need much space to produce a crop.
So here we are out at the desert raisin plantation. How many acres have you got growing here, Max?
1 hectare. 1 hectare is the total size.
How many tonnes of desert raisins are you getting off your hectare crop each year?
We're not getting tonnes, it's called kilos, but average of 900.
900 kilos each year?
Average, yes.
Hello, I'm Nathan Coates at Max Emery's place near Rainbow Valley, about 100 kilometres southeast of Alice Springs in central Australia. It's a pretty tough climate to grow anything out here. Blistering temperatures and a lack of reliable water sources certainly limit your choices, but bush raisins seem to do okay, and Max gets $32 a kilo for his efforts. The plants are about knee-high and covered in round, small fruit, but they're not for eating like the dried raisins you'd find in the supermarket. These are destined for a very different end use.
Well, let's go and have a look then, eh?
What we do need is another 5 inches of rain, eh? That would make a difference. These ones have just got, some of them have got fruit just coming on again. It's a new lot starting again. It's new season fruit just starting again. And they're looking quite well. It's still quite a good number of fruit on there. We'll look around the garden a little bit further.
So what are your thoughts on these ones?
These are exceptionally good fruit coming on this new part of the season. They're looking to be about 25 mil, which is a very good size. And the volume looks to be somewhere in the vicinity of about 10 kilo per plant. We won't know for about another month's time, but it's looking very, very good at this stage.
And what's the process of picking?
Well, at the moment you'll see there's a number of yellow fruit on there. As long as the fruit is whole yellow and no green on it, that is ready to harvest.
So you literally have people just walking around, bent over, picking up the raisins, putting them in a basket?
That's correct, yes. We go around daily and harvest all the ripe fruit. As long as you keep harvesting the ripe fruit all the time, new flowers will keep appearing at the top of the plant and ultimately you'll get more fruit.
So what we're looking at here is the cleaning and drying table. Is that right, Max?
Yep. Right. First thing when you harvest is you've got to bring them in and clean all the calyxes off. Calyx is the little stubby piece that holds the fruit to the plant. On many of these fruits, they'll stay attached. Some will actually, you can harvest without the calyx coming off the plant, but in many cases they won't, so you've got to physically take them off every single fruit. And in a single day, we usually do about 10,000 calyxes, which is quite a lot of time cleaning fruit. Then once they're cleaned, if they haven't got any dirt or anything attached because of any rain, and obviously we don't get very much rain, so we don't get much dirt on the fruit, we then put them onto the drying tables, and we look for about 43 degrees average, and that way these fruit will be fully dried in 2 days and we can have them ready for market. They go down, first they go down to Melbourne to the processing turnout, and then they're milled. If they're not quite dry hard enough, we like to get them down to at least 4% moisture. And so then it goes through the milling machine after the dryer, and it is fine ground, and then eventually it finds itself either into cooking pots with tomato sauce, making beautiful chutneys, or it's finding its way into the meat industry. Because it carries a natural selenium, one of the only natural selenium preservatives in any plant, it is really a very popular thing to go into meat.
You're talking about sausages?
In sausage meat, yes. In sausage meat, it can go into meat patties. And what it does is it increases the shelf life of meat, and it also enhances the meat. One of the things that in beef sausage was not always popular, that it had a sort of a funny taste to it at times, probably coming off the beef fat. And this neutralises that taste and actually enhances the fruits, the meat itself. And so it become very, very popular. And they sell a lot of this.
So they're not actually sold as raisins like you would think. They go, as you say, they get ground up and end up as chutney or as a filler in and preservative in sausages.
That's right. Yeah, there's very little market for the desert raisin to be sold as is. It is an additive.
So there you have it, bush raisins, not your regular dried fruit. Nathan Coates with that story from Central Australia. Still to come on Rural Reporter, we're entering jams and preserves in the Ekka and growing macadamias in a cold climate.
Another nut in there.
Ah, there's another nut in there. What do you do with the nuts?
I open them.
And what do you do when you open them?
Okay. Open that one.
Well, I don't think we can open that one yet.
Two-year-old Toby Carmody could be a third-generation macadamia nut grower when he grows up.
Open this one.
Open this one? You can try.
Nothing unusual in that, I hear you say. But when you understand where the farm is, that's what makes this story. Hello, I'm Laura Poole. The Carmody's farm isn't in the subtropical, warm climate of northern New South Wales or Queensland, where macadamia trees usually thrive. This orchard is in frost-prone Druin in Victoria's Gippsland, just an hour east of Melbourne. Toby's dad, Brad, is taking me on a tour of Australia's southernmost macadamia farm.
Where can you get some from? What are you getting? Okay, so yeah, Druin Macadamia Farm, there's about 125 trees on the farm. Each tree produces around about 10 kilos of nuts a season, has been doing so since about 2009. We had our first nuts a little bit earlier than that in 2001, after the crop was originally planted in the early 90s, about 1992, I think.
Because that's the thing about macadamia trees, they're take a notoriously long time to produce anything.
Yes, definitely. I think a few people probably thought my dad was a little bit mad when he planted the seeds in the early 90s, but he's a very patient man, and we knew it was going to take at least 10 years before we saw any harvest. But yeah, it's now well and truly firing, so it's been good.
Did you help put the trees in?
Yes, I remember he sourced nuts from a few different places, some from Queensland. I remember driving out to Sassafras in the Dandenongs to pick some up, and my brother and I and mum, we definitely helped plant. We were hands-on from the very beginning.
And now it's a dense forest here in Druin.
It is. I guess Dad must have known how big they were going to grow, but yeah, it's very dense, and you can definitely get lost amongst the leaves and amongst the trees. And I know Mum spends a lot of time foraging through finding the nuts when they drop from around about March till September, October during the harvest time.
Are they a hard tree to take care of?
They're actually surprisingly low maintenance. Early on we put hessian bags around, and I know we had some snails and a few things like that that we had to stop, and no chemicals or anything have been used, all natural. For whatever reason, they've thrived in the Druin climate.
Because it would have to be one of the most, or if not the most, southern macadamia farm in Australia.
Definitely. We believe that we're the only macadamia farm in Victoria. Mostly Queensland and high New South Wales, I believe, is where most of the macadamia nuts in Australia are found. But for whatever reason, they've worked in the climate in Druin, and it's going as strong as ever.
So if we just go for a walk here underneath this macadamia tree, how many metres is that tall now?
Looking at 3 or 4 metres tall, maybe even 5 metres tall, and almost as wide.
Yeah.
With 125 of them, that definitely fills up our 1 hectare property quite well.
And if we look down on the ground, we can just see nuts here on the ground, not quite ready to eat though.
No, they're not quite ready. So they come off in their, they're in their husks, and you actually we have picked them up by hand, and when you open up the husk, that you can see the macadamia in its shell, and from that stage they still need to be dried out. So if it's about 20 degrees, they dry themselves out, probably take about a month. But Mum and Dad have the wood fire going inside, and there's trays of nuts all around it, making sure that they're ripe. they're right and ready to go.
Yeah, so it's not drying at the moment. It's certainly not 20 degrees in Druin in August.
No, definitely not.
And I met your two-year-old earlier, and he has a bit of fun with the macadamias inside.
Yes, he does indeed. He loves helping his nanny and grandpa pick them up outside, walking around the 2.5 acres. And inside, mum and dad have really organise the way where all their nuts are, so the different seasons, and they know exactly how long they need to dry. And Toby, if he gets a chance, will put his hand and throw them around, but we need to make sure that whatever he throws goes back into the same box.
Do I have a ruler?
What does it take to enter the perfect cake or the perfect preserve in the Royal Queensland Show?
Here we go.
Is it about the icing? Is it about the correct jam set, or is it more about the tradition, experience, and attention to detail? Hello, I'm Jessica Hinchliffe, and I love to cook, especially jams and preserves, and for the first time ever, I've decided to give it a go. I'm entering my very special strawberry and balsamic jam and my bread and butter cucumber pickles in the novice section at this year's ECCA. Now, what I thought would involve just dropping off a few jars to the Brisbane showgrounds turned out to be a little harder. There's a really long list of do's and don'ts that you need to adhere to if you're going to win that coveted blue ribbon. For example, before the judges even open the lid, you have to make sure your jar is the correct size and correctly labelled.
3 centimetres up the jar. 3 centimetres from the base of the jar. So the base, 1, 2, 3, the bottom edge of the label to be 3 centimetres from the base.
So are all the rules and regulations absolutely necessary, or do they discourage younger, would-be competitors like me from entering? ECCA Cookery judge Jeanette Johnson and Lynette Pierce have more than 30 years of judging experience between them. Jeanette says the rules are there for a reason.
It's to make sure everyone is being judged on a level playing field so that there's no favouritisms or anything like that.
How long does it take you to judge the categories? Because there's quite a few to go through, and I think you've still got another to go.
Well, depending on how many entries there are per category and on how good they are, I mean, if there's one or two that are outstanding, that makes it easier. But when they're all much of a muchness, we hum and ha, we do confer a lot, and we eventually do come up with a winner.
What do you enjoy most about it?
Probably the variety of cooking that's here, just the social aspect of it. You get to meet your friends again.
An annual get-together nearly.
That's right, yes.
Any tips for people that might be thinking of entering next year? They've got a whole year now to start planning their entries.
I would say go for it. Do it. It's a wonderful experience. If you like cooking, trial a few times first before you put your final one in. And maybe it'll win a prize. You never know.
Sue Hennessy is the counsellor for Fine Arts and Cookery at the ECCA, and she says it's all about practice.
Show cooking is different from home cooking. And with show cooking, you must abide by all of the rules and the regulations. If at first you don't succeed in achieving the size you want, then you need to rethink it all, measure your ingredients, make sure your doughs are measured, and then cook them, do a trial batch. If it doesn't work, try again.
We're standing here in front of all the wonderful preserves that have been judged. It is becoming quite trendy to preserve these days. Did you see an increase in those entries?
Yes, they've been increasing every year. We're getting more and more entries in the preserves, and the varieties are quite amazing. And the variation in colours too, if you look at the lemon butters, you'll see many different colours for the same product. And it all depends on your eggs and how you beat them. And, you know, there's many things to think of to get the perfect lemon butter.
Standing in here today, the smells, the minute you walk into all the judging, it must be hard to walk by all these goods.
I'd always like to bring in my own knife and cut one of the fruit cakes, but I think I'd be wrapped over the knuckles by the judges if I did that. But the aromas from the puddings and the fruit cakes are superb.
And how much work do the judges put into the judging? Because you have quite a few here today.
Particularly the cookery judges, they are here for a full day and a half to do the judging. And there are teams of the judges and also teams of stewards who assist the judges.
And these stewards are volunteers who come in, but they are well versed in the cookery rules and regulations.
Such a huge mission, but I better let you go. I know there's still some rocky road being judged.
Yes, I'd love to try some of that.
Okay. You got jams?
I do have jams. That's this one? Here. No worries, thank you.
And what surname is it?
Hinchley.
That one. That's the strawberry something.
Yeah, let's see. Well, it's a jam, any one variety.
So, how did I go in the novice competition? Was it worth all that time and that effort to enter the Eckers Cookery Competition? Well, the answer is yes. I'm pleased as punch to report my strawberry and balsamic jam is a winner, and my bread and butter pickled cucumbers came in second. You certainly don't do it for the prize money, just $30. For both of those winning entries, but of course you get to keep the ribbons. I do have to say, I'm hooked. I'll definitely be back next year, but this time competing in the open section. I'll be up against the big guns and the top preservers from throughout the country. So I think I better get back into the kitchen and start practicing now.
And yes, well done, Jess Hinchcliffe, on winning a blue ribbon at the Ecker. And good luck next year when you're going to have to step up to the open section. When you see pictures of places in drought, do you feel some sympathy? Or is there some part of you that asks, well, do these farmers know what they're doing and should we be propping up communities like these that are struggling? This morning, we'll travel to some of those towns doing it pretty tough in Queensland, where it's the very character of the people and the place that lets them survive and rebuild, even after the worst of times.
How did German lager come to dominate the world's beer market? What's happened to French intellectuals? Why the lack of confidence? Or there's the reinvention of money. Who were the brains behind Bitcoin? And speaking of brains, Norman Doidge explains neuroplasticity and how to manage chronic pain. All big ideas on big ideas and all available for download from the RN homepage or via the ABC radio app.
While skinny cows and dusty landscapes remain the popular image of drought, the less overt picture is one of a handful of people in each town rallying their tired community to cope with the financial and emotional stress. From Western Queensland, Cameron Wilson reports on the social cost of drought and how communities respond.
Area 3, we've got Jackass wearing, what colour is he? Jackass is in the yellow and pink. We've got 50-50 is in the lime green, he's barrier 4.
Today's one of the big events on the social calendar for Baduri, which is in far western Queensland, just on the edge of the Channel country, really. It's the camel races, the annual camel races, and I'm with Trevor Stewart, who's also known as Colgate, who's the president of the Golf and Leisure Club, the group that put on the Baduri camel races. Colgate, got a few here today.
Yeah, no, it's a good crowd. We're sort of hoping it's around 500, but we'll know once we do the gate takings and that, so yep. With the kids and properties and all that sort of come in and the tourists, so it builds up pretty quick.
Where do the camels come from?
They come from all over. Like, there's a lot from Boulia, and then you got all down in South Australia and Victoria and New South Wales. They come from all far and wide.
I was watching before. One just took off in totally the wrong direction.
Yeah, no, you get that. So, and if you got money on it, well, you're a loser.
So this is an area that's, you know, it's pretty dry around here and right around the region. People have been doing it tough for probably 3 or 4 years now. How important is a day like today?
Very important to bring everyone together. Like, the drought's been pretty hard, you know, on a lot of the places, even for town people, because of work and all that sort of stuff has, you know, died off. And these sort of things like this sort of boost the community and people let their hair down, have some fun and go away, you know, for the next 3 or 4 weeks happy.
Oh, well, I better let you go because there's people after you everywhere. Yeah. When's the next race start?
It'll be the plate and it'll start, well, I'll tell you, I've got my form guide here. It'll be at 2:15.
All right, and your tip?
Well, I don't know. I think Chief is pretty good, but the one that won the first race, Peter Pumpkin Eater.
So Peter Pumpkin Eater over Chief, you reckon, for the Quinella?
That's me tip.
All right, we'll see if you're right. Thanks, Colgate. All the best.
No, thank you.
Looks like fairly even field from this start here. Away they go. We've got on the inside, Chief looking good. Calico there as well. They're coming up. Hand Dog, I think, might be in front here. Chief coming back hard. Oh, look at this here, ladies and gentlemen. Camp Dog, I mean, he's got him. I think Camp Dog might have got him, ladies and gentlemen, by a whip. Chief got second.
For the record, Peter Pumpkin-Eater came in last. But the results of the races aren't really the point. Most of the locals accept that days like these are valuable. They offer a chance to momentarily forget the drought, or at least discuss its pressures amongst friends. It's also an opportunity to keep an eye out for one another. And then, of course, there's the extra money being spent by visitors in town. About 400 kilometres east of Baduri, Windora is holding a big event of its own this weekend. It's the weekend Gymkhana and Stockman's Challenge here in Windora, which is by Cooper Creek in western Queensland. It's channel country and it's part of Australia that's well and truly in drought at the moment. Bruce Scott is a local here in Windora and he's been involved in looking at the sort of assistance communities need to get through the dry times, not just here in Windora but also beyond Blackall, all the way up to Longreach, that sort of area. Bruce, we'll start with what's going on here today. It looks like you've got a few people for the event.
Yes, Cameron, there is a few here today. People travel quite a distance to come to these local events, and it's to enter into the sporting horse and motorbike sporting, and also the Stockman's Challenge. And tomorrow we've got the traditional Bronco branding, which was the traditional way of branding and marking calves before yards were built.
How dry is it coming in, flying in? We followed the Barcoo on the way in, and not too much water in it, but there's nothing unusual about that. Just give me a sense of how dry it really is around the Channel Country at the moment.
As you're aware, as your listeners are aware, the Channel Country exists basically on the flooding of these this great basin, and that hasn't happened to a sense that it actually created any feed for it. This will be the third summer we're coming into now where there hasn't been a useful flood in the river. So that has an impact on the turning off of livestock. So that's one aspect. So when the rains don't come in the north and the east of this catchment, it just goes to show how dry that part of the world is also.
Mm. Yeah, and it's the whole region, isn't it? We've seen the Downs country as well, up towards Longreach, and pretty dry there.
Yeah, Cameron, I don't think I've seen it that dry in that Mitchell Grass Downs country ever, and that I can remember.
Throughout the district, what are communities doing to try to make sure everyone gets through the period as well as can be expected?
Yeah, I think people generally keep a bit of an eye out for each other. May not seem it at the time, but just sometimes a phone call or a friendly slap on the back goes a long way. You know, how you going? You know, what's happening? Just a beer and a cup of tea sometimes is pretty useful. But quite often when it's dry, people don't take the time to do those things, and we lose a little bit of social cohesion. And I think we're all getting a little bit older too, so our kids are off our hands. There's less and less younger children in the communities, or has been for a while. We're starting to see a little bit of a change in that now, but there's less of a need to come together when there's not a lot of little kids.
Kids do that, don't they?
They do. They bring you together, and so it's great to see in a town like Windora, we're starting to see a few babies being born, a few toddlers getting ready for school, and that causes a natural reaction in itself.
Drives you mad when you've got to ferry them around everywhere, but there's a benefit to that.
Well, it is, Cameron. Our kids are growing up and working or at university, and so are our neighbours growing up. So we don't probably come together as much as we used to as neighbours. But we're having the fun of our friends, our younger friends, having little kids. So we sort of enjoy their company and enjoy being around their kids. And so that's good.
Bruce Scott from Windora. This is Country Breakfast on RN, taking a look at how drought is affecting the social and community side of life in Western Queensland. Well, as Bruce said, young kids can be a great unifier, and that's invaluable during the dry. But parents out this way are also acutely aware the kids feel the stress of drought too. What you've been hearing there is a couple of kids from the Prairie Primary School practicing. Well, not practicing, they were playing their piano. They've been learning since late last year. I'm actually in Hughenden at the moment, which is in central northwest Queensland. And Prairie is about 40 kilometres east from here. It's a little school that's there. It's only about 7 kids that attend permanently. There's also a distance education element as well. But what they've been doing over the last 3 terms now is really interesting. It's trying to get music into the curriculum to help kids during tough times, really, times of drought. Sharon Johnson's one of the parents at the Prairie Primary School. And Sharon, they were your kids, were they, that I heard there?
Two of them were, yes.
They've learned a bit.
They have. They've done extremely well in a very short period of time. I'm very surprised how much they've learnt, but I'm scared kids are sponges and they take it all in.
I saw flying in here that it's dry. What, yes. You must be 4 or 5 years into drought?
Into the fourth year, I think. Yeah. Who knows? We lose count, honestly. It's just every day is just right. Oh, it hasn't rained. We're just knuckling in and getting on with what we have to do.
So does the drought in any way affect the kids and their education? I'm just interested if that was a driver for wanting to get the music as part of the curriculum.
Yes, it does. The kids don't say so much, but they're seeing the potty calves come in, they're seeing the cows dying, they see their old horses getting skinnier and that we're having to supplement their feed. So they're seeing that, and it sort of becomes... Kids are so very resilient, they see that. But the music brings so much joy because they get down and they play their music or they sing their song or they do their dance or they make their music video, and it's such a joyful part of learning, and it gives them brightens their day. And I have to say, even as parents and adults going through this whole thing, that seeing the kids enjoying it so much and we watch their performances, it brings us a lot of joy too.
So it's for the parents as well?
I think so. Yeah. You know, it's not specifically for the parents, but it's such a flow-on effect. Yeah. And I used to play music and I'll get down and I'll play the keyboard with the kids, and I haven't done that for 20 years.
So they've been the catalyst.
Yeah, that's right.
It's clearly not cheap to get a teacher to come and visit from out of town. It's once a fortnight, I think, is it?
Once a fortnight, yes.
How have you paid for it?
This particular block of lessons, we've been very fortunate that we were successful in a Tackling Tough Times grant through the FRRR Foundation, and we've been so grateful to get that because it is expensive, and finding that money in a very small community in our fundraising efforts, it takes a lot of effort.
But Prairie's a town of, what is it, 55 people?
55 people max,
yeah. So there's only so much fundraising you can
That's
do.
That's right. We make sandwiches at the races, and we're fortunate enough that we get to clean... to clean the local toilets for the council, which is a constant income for us that we get every year. But it's
because you're on the grey nomad trail here, aren't you?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. We get to see the grey nomads up close and personal. so we're very fortunate for that. But again, there's a little bit of a shortfall that we've got to try and catch up every year.
And that's where you look to philanthropy, I guess.
That's exactly right, yes. Yeah. We look to see what funding and grants are available.
Yeah. So, Sharon, just before I head off, we should get one of the kids to show us some violin, shouldn't we? Not in the chicken coop, but just here in... Not in the chicken run, but just here in the park.
We can do that.
Georgie! Run back here, please!
Georgie, can we hear something on the violin that you've been learning?
Sure. I can play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Sharon's point that money is getting hard to raise is a concern just about everywhere. The small businesses just can't afford to get behind the kids' concert or camp, the camel races, or a local ladies' day like they usually would. Families are stretched too, and there's only so much money that can be raised by scrubbing toilets and selling sandwiches. There is some federal government money available. About $30 million has been earmarked for mental health, social and community programs, and there's some other state money as well. But it's not always reaching the people and the communities that need it. The Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal has been funding projects in isolated towns that are aimed at improving mental well-being or preparing the community for future droughts. FRRR Chief Executive is Alex Gartman, and she's been assessing the benefits of that money.
Well, it's very much about reducing isolation and ensuring that there are connections within and between and across communities. So when we think about social capital, which is really critical in a community viability, social capital is about how well the community is bonded within the community, how well it is connected between communities, and how well it's networked with influencers and decision makers. And I think that events where you get to bring people together face to face enables that connection to take place. And so events that bring together not just local people but people from outside of the region and metropolitan centres actually does build social capital because you're creating connections and networks with a whole diverse range of people.
So do you have a handle on what still needs to be done? Because these communities are still in drought.
They certainly are. And we know, you know, we heard time and time again that volunteer fatigue is a major challenge. And we acknowledge that tourism is certainly a key component to the economy. But the challenge is there's the same people doing and hosting those events each and every weekend to attract people. And the benefit is often for visitors to the area to have a great time, but the locals are almost stuffed at the end of it. So we recognise that that's a key challenge. Probably also there's a lot of conversations about capacity and leadership and being able to have community conversations to redesign the future.
Alex Gartman. Well, despite the pressure and the challenge of drought and that volunteer fatigue that Alex referred to, there is something of an appetite for a new look future in Western Queensland. In Longreach, there's talk of better cooperation between pastoralists and tourism operators so they can bring in more visitors. In the smaller town of Julia Creek, there are plans to be the preferred camping point for the grey nomads. And in the tiny town of Erromanga, that mosquito-like noise is the sound of a big plan that's already in action. A plan to become a centrepiece in the region's dinosaur fossil trail. The hope is that locally discovered bones will underpin a tourism and education industry. That's all in the future, but this is a project that's already paying dividends for the handful of local volunteers who spend their time cleaning the dirt off dinosaur bones with the help of those noisy and expensive tools. Gemma Murray is one of the volunteers here at the Erromanga Natural History Museum. Gemma, can you just explain to me what you're working on here?
This is a piece of bone from a dinosaur nicknamed Tom, and we are removing the surface concretion from the bone to expose the actual bone surface. And that's pretty much it. It's a very long and slow and dedicated process.
Mm. How important is it to the community here and to the town that you have this project?
I think longer term it'll be a great benefit to the community. Immediately it's provided opportunities for all of us as volunteers to come in and help and be involved. Once the museum's open to the public, I suspect that during the tourist season out here that we will have a lot of visitors, and then of course as that increases there'll be a lot of, you know, flow-on benefit to the community from people staying and then telling other people, and hopefully more people coming and telling other people.
Can you measure how important something like this has been during the years of drought?
It's been a great mental change of space and capacity for us all. You can come here and be locked in a room, and the day-to-day stresses of what's going on at home aren't here. So you're not having to deal with them by facing them. They're here. You have that mental change of space, I assume, to be able to learn to cope, to devise other plans.
Yeah. Well, I better let you get back to it, because it's reasonably delicate work, isn't it? Quite time-consuming. Gemma, all the best with it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So whether it's working on an internationally significant dinosaur fossil or simply teaching isolated kids to play a musical instrument, what's become clear is that the projects and activities and the tasks that bring small towns together are always valuable, but they become critical during drought. It seems the challenge is now to continue this effort as the drought wears on and money, time and energy become scarce. Perhaps the longer term challenge is to inspire more people to set their sights on contributing more at a local level, on a seemingly small scale task that really makes a difference in the long run. Bruce Scott, who you met back at the Gymkhana at Windora, thinks all Australians actually have an interest in that outcome, even if they've never been to the outback and never lived through a drought.
I get quite tired of people say you choose to live there. And it's great that people do choose to live here, because someone's got to live here. And the people that live here enjoy living here. They do it because they like it. But if they didn't like it, there'd be a huge vacuum in regional Australia, and there'd be no one there to maintain the roads. There'd be no one there to bring beef into the abattoirs and onto ships. There'd be no one to, you know, collect the grain. There'd be no one to collect oil and gas out of the remote gas and oil fields. So it's pretty important stuff to the big picture. It's not just about, you know, welfare for small communities. It's about making sure that the cogs and the wheels that keep our economy chugging along happen. It's not just about high population areas. The high population areas benefit from people living and working in the inland.
Bruce Scott from Windora in Western Queensland, ending that report by Cameron Wilson. And Cameron travelled with the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal. That's the program for this week. A big thanks to Carey Dell, who makes us all sound good. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast to listen anytime at abc.net.au/rural. I'm Edwina Farley. Stay listening on RN.